Okay, so for our final class, to wrap it up, we've seen a few key stories in Tanakh of Jewish victories. We started with the story of the Exodus itself and the Song of the Sea. We moved to David and Goliath and the story of Chizkiah with Sancheiriv. But now I wanted to bring it to modern times because we can talk about stories in Tanakh. And then we have sort of a break for a very long time where the Jews aren't quite victorious at all. And then we come to the modern period, and with the advent of the State of Israel, we have a series of victories, starting in 1948 through modern times, really modern times, through now. But I think that some of the lessons that we've seen from the stories in Tanakh can be applied and actually were applied by early rabbinic authorities when the state first began to understand and contextualize how we're supposed to experience the modern state of Israel. So that's really what I want to focus on. A little bit of history before we get into the sources on the page. Right, so as we know, Israel, right, was declared a state and fought its first war in 1948. And that was, by all accounts, a war against innumerable odds. But the Jews survived and won. But already we're fighting another war by 1956 over the canal. And then in 1967... they had what was perhaps their most famous victory, being the victory in the Six-Day War. Now, when you look at the victories, so in certain ways, in many ways, they compare to biblical victories, right? They're of biblical proportions, if you would, but in different ways. So, if we think about biblical battles, right? Especially some of those that we've seen. Right, what generally typifies those amazing stories in Tanakh and the Torah of battles? Right, that we fight against the God, that there'd be David and Goliath, or later on, stories we didn't get to, the Maccabees. And whether it be the story that we saw briefly last week of Gideon, where Gideon, like God says, your army of 32,000 people is already outnumbered, get rid of some of the army before you fight, and we go down to 10,000, and no, that's too much. So we go down to 300, and with 300 people, they manage to beat the army of Midian. Right, whatever it might be, we have these battles against innumerable opponents. But often, and as we saw already in the story of David and Goliath, right, is that the Jews... Exactly. The Jews win not just because of miracles, not just plain miracles, not just like God. Some of them are like the Battle of Sancheiriv, the non-battle of Sennacherib that we saw last week, where they're outnumbered. So, it could be that God could have made them be excellent fighters, but instead God decided that they woke up in the morning and 175,000 soldiers were dead surrounding the city. So sometimes, it's just a straight miracle. You don't do anything and your enemies are they just disappear. They evaporate. Or the way we started, the splitting of the sea, right? We have a huge army coming towards us, we split the sea, we walk through, we get to the other side, they're stuck in the middle, the sea comes crashing down, our enemies are gone. But there are others, like David and Goliath, where there's a bit of thinking out of the box, there's a little bit of wisdom, and that really is how we win. Also, if you think to the story that we touched on 2 weeks ago, at the end, the story of Gideon. Right? So if you remember, how did Gideon, right, with his 300 men, what really led to the victory? So we talked about, what?
Noise.
Right, the noise, meaning the confusion, right? And what did that cause? That caused, in many ways, people to turn on each other in fright. They were just so confused, they started killing each other, right? Even not, in friendly fire, just like trampling each other, running out. And often, the biblical stories play on confusion. Right, that we turn our enemies against each other, not necessarily on purpose, sometimes on purpose, not necessarily on purpose, simply by, that's the way God carries out his miracles, by bringing about confusion. And if you think about the wars in Israel, different wars fit into the different of these categories. So like the war in 1948 is, on the one hand, almost, you know, out almost textbook Maccabee story. It's the, you know, as we say in Al-Hanisim, we'll come back to, the many into the hands of the few. Right? These were, you know, refugees, many refugees from the Holocaust who were just gathered in Israel against all these Arab armies, and they won by a mixture of, you know, what can only be described as miracles and nerve. Right? I mean, my grandfather was, I think he got to Israel in 1947 from a DP camp in Austria, and was already fighting in 1948. You know, he'd spent the 6 years before that in Siberia. You know, this was fighting, right? It was this, what? Yeah, they had nothing to lose, and they fought and with tenacity. But it was a small group of people. It's basically the way we describe the army of Gideon, right? They don't even really have weapons, right? Gideon's army is using, like, they're using farm tools, because what else do they have? You know, they have spears and hoes, and, you know, they'll just be hitting people over the head with shovels. That's basically what's going on. It's a bunch of farmers from the Yishuv and refugees from Europe, and with whatever weapons they have and, you know, whatever they can find. Right, they had, you know, random, and, you know, they had Maccabee-style guerrilla fighters that helped a bit, you know, the Haganah, and the Irgun, and the Palmach, and all the different organizations that we had. So on the one hand, it's very biblical, and the, you know, many into the hands of the few, but it's also has a lot of the characteristics, the desperation that you hear sometimes in Tanakh with a little bit of chachma, a little bit of wisdom, a little bit of guerrilla tactics, whatever it took, right, to win. 1967 is a really interesting case, because, you know, if you think about it historically, we all just think of it as the many into the hands of the few. Like, we were surrounded by many, many, many armies, and it was just a miracle. No one thought we would win, and everybody thought we would be driven into the sea. The truth is much more complicated than that. If you get a chance, I was scholar in residence in New York over Shabbos, so I had the distinct pleasure of being stranded at the airport in both directions and having plenty of time to read. So I managed to get through the whole book, which is better than last time. This is Michael Oren's 6 Days of War, which is excellent. And Michael Oren, the former ambassador, Israeli ambassador to the U.S., when I tried to read his book on America's involvement in the Middle East since 1776, it's a like 700-page monstrosity. It's excellent, but it took me a few months. This took me 2 plane delays. What he notes is that 1967, on the one hand, we were outnumbered. In terms of sheer numbers, we were outnumbered by a lot. But on the other hand, the assessments of the military experts in America and in Great Britain and in Israel, for that matter, was that we were going to win no matter what. Like, they went in thinking that we were going to win this battle. The only question was I said this to someone who got very angry, but the assumption was that they would win. The question was how much would they have to lose in order to win. They thought eventually they would win, because if you look, a lot of the same things that happened in the Bible that turn the tables away from the person with the numbers were present in the Six-Day War. You had a lot of political machinations going on that meant that basically the Arabs were all working against each other, because, right, Jordan was strong-armed into joining this alliance with Egypt because Hussein was going to lose his throne to pro-Nasserites in Jordan, so he forges an alliance with Egypt, but he's also pro-American, so his hands are tied because he has to follow the Arab world following Nasser, but he can't fully give up on America, so he's constantly trying to balance, right, balance, which really hamstrings him in many ways. Nasser is so afraid to... Nasser's officers were so afraid to admit that they'd lost their air force that for the first few hours they told Nasser that they were winning, which Nasser then passed on to Jordan, which encouraged Jordan to fight, even when they were losing the war. And then Iraq lied to Jordan and told them that they had already sent their air force, which was giving them cover, which they weren't. And then Jordan's, and then, you know, Syria is the one that started it all, but holds off on entering the war. And Syria only, you know, enters the war towards the end. And really, Israel sort of, you know, manipulates them into the war so that they can fight them because they were the ones who started the war. And there's just a lot of confusion that leads to you know, the success. You have Egyptians, and because at certain points in the war, because the Egyptians were hearing on the radio that they were winning, when they saw victorious soldiers marching towards them, they assumed that they were Egyptians, so the Israelis got within just a few meters of them before they realized they were Israelis, right, which allowed them to have victory. And other points, they thought they started shooting at, they saw people fleeing and they assumed they were Israelis, but they were in fact Egyptians who knew that they were losing, and they started shooting each other, right? There's all the confusion that you find in biblical stories where the miracles happen, not just, you know, you shoot a gun and it magically kills 100,000 people, but that God sort of arranged that even though we were outnumbered numerically, we weren't actually outnumbered politically, because there was so much infighting that God, through the natural means of the insanity of the Arab world, brought about our victory, right? You just feel like you're reliving many different biblical stories, right? You know, I had a seminar at some point with Michael Doran. Michael Doran is excellent. He was an advisor on the Middle East to the Bush administration. He's at Brookings or, you know, one of these think tanks. He's an expert on the Middle East, where he said that in 48 you actually had a lot of this also. A lot of the reason we could win against such odds was because the Arabs were fighting each other constantly, and even when they were actually trying to make each other lose, because they were all fighting for power, because in the partition, it wasn't just Israel which was being partitioned, but the whole Middle East was in the middle of being divided, and they hated each other. So, you know, when they knew, you know, if you were trying to win a battle, so you would send the strongest army, but often what they wanted to do was humiliate the other Arabs by making them lose to the Jews, so they would guilt different armies going in when they weren't ready for battle, right? So when you read it, it is biblical in the sense of Rabim miyad me'atim, of the many into the hands of the few, but it's also biblical in the sense that God performed miracles through confusion, right? Through helping us win you can only describe it as miraculous, by generating so much confusion that that gave us the upper hand. Yeah?
On the other side of the coin, the fact that the Arab countries or all these other nations did work together causes the confusion. If you think about our own personal history as Jews, we say the temple was destroyed because of Sinat Chinam, which is that type of confusion.
Yeah.
Mine would take through, if we had only worked together, we could have allayed the ones who were attacking us in the temple. We could have fought in the Holocaust. We could have worked together. I mean, it's hard against the gun, but perhaps we would have had more wins.
Yeah, I mean, unity, you know, we've fallen prey to the same type of, you know, infighting. But, you know, it's no less miraculous at the right time they were falling prey to this infighting. And this is even when there was supposed to be an alliance. I mean, you read the politics, the miracles of, you know, at least one of the battles began because, you know, King Hussein had wanted to delay one of the battles from starting, but he didn't want to directly talk to the Israelis, so he'd sent a letter of apology for something that had happened to the ambassador in, one of the Western ambassadors, to then relay on to Israel, but the person had decided not to open the letter until the next morning, by which point fighting had already started because they thought that, right, they wanted war and they didn't get the letter of regret, and by the time it got there, it had been rescinded, right? I mean, if you want all the details in painstaking detail, you can read through the book. It's an excellent book. But I think because it shares so many of those elements with the biblical stories, it is important to think about, okay, well, then what were the lessons we've learned from the biblical victories in the last few weeks? And how does that shape how we should view the modern state of Israel and the victories that we've had, both understanding the miraculous elements and the natural elements of the miraculous parts of it? So if you look at the sources I put here, sort of just to capture the the struggle here, actually, of, you know, how we're supposed to respond emotionally. I put two pictures here. On the left-hand side, I put, you know, the classic paratrooper picture. The other book, by the way, if you want to really feel the Six-Day War, is Like Dreamers, which is an excellent book. So good. By Yossi Klein Halevi. That's a bit different. This is like a war memoir of the Six-Day War. Yossi Klein Halevi writes from the experience of six paratroopers, their lead up to the war itself, and then the movement that they started. What? Like Dreamers. And follows six of the paratroopers in their life that they follow afterwards, because their reaction to the Six-Day War maps onto the schism in Israeli society. One of them, you know, founds Gush Emunim, right, and founds the settler movement. One of them forms Peace Now. Right? One of them becomes a spy for the PLO and is imprisoned for treason. Right, like. And then eventually does, you know, repents and becomes a professor. Right? It's a fascinating book which follows sort of how 1967 shaped the future of Jewish history. Absolutely excellent. All his books are excellent. His book, The Making of the Jewish Extremist, is also fascinating, which is his personal journey from being a Kahanist to being a interfaith. A mediator of interfaith dialogue. He's a fascinating individual. He came to speak to us at some point when I was in yeshiva. Okay, but if you look at on the left hand side, we have the picture here of the paratroopers, that sign of victory. But on the right hand side, and here we get the religious element, you have Rav Goren, Shlomo Goren, who was at the time the chief rabbi of the IDF, who became the chief rabbi of Israel, blowing the shofar, right? Because there was that religious moment, right? It wasn't just victory. Like, everyone understood, and you read the memoirs of people, right? Even people who were totally secular, had no, you know, were not at all believers. There was something, right? They just felt there was something bigger than them going on here, religiously, not just nationally. Okay. Now, this sentiment that was captured by the rabbis in Israel, at the beginning of the state, and then again in 67. So if you look at number one, this is a passage from the Talmud, describing Purim. Right? How did we get Purim? Now, Purim is another one of those battles, right? One of those victories where, you know, it's a series of miracles that were hidden, right? We always talk about Purim is hidden miracles. It was a bit of, you know, a series of happy coincidences combined with just a little bit of belief, a little bit of tenacity, a little bit of chutzpah, right? A little bit of wisdom, right? A little bit of political machinations, right? And we've managed to pull off an impressive battle, an impressive victory. So, how did it become a holiday? So if you look at number one, the Talmud says as follows. The rabbis taught 48 prophets and 7 prophetesses prophesied, really, to Israel. And they neither took away from nor added what is written in the Torah, save only the reading of the Megillah. So normally the role of a prophet was to exhort, was to tell people, keep the Torah, keep what God already told you. But they didn't add new laws, but there's an exception. They added Purim, they added the reading of the Megillah. Now how did they derive it from the Torah? Where did they get this notion that we needed a holiday for Purim? Right? Meaning, you think about it, it's post-biblical. Right? Most of the prophets, whether it be, you know, it be Isaiah or it be Jeremiah, they're telling people be ethical, keep Shabbat. You know, they're just going back to the Torah. But here in Esther, we have a new holiday. So where do you get it from? So Rabbi Chiya bar Avin said in the name of Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha, if we're being delivered from slavery to freedom, we chant a hymn of praise. Should we not do so all the more for being delivered from death to life? He said, what do you mean? I looked at the Torah and I said, how did we react to our first victory, which was really just getting us out of slavery? We have a holiday. We have Pesach. We have Passover. And here we were saved from genocide, and we're not going to make a holiday. I mean, they saw latent in the Torah itself this notion that the way to react to a miracle, right? Now, there's a jump that they're not actually telling you, is that Passover is open miracles. Right? So you might have thought maybe we only celebrate when there's open miracles. But the Talmud tells you no. We don't just celebrate when there are open miracles. We celebrate when there was a miracle that saved us. If Passover, we were saved through open miracles, but it was less of a salvation, I mean, we're saved from slavery, and on Purim, we were slaved from genocide, then I don't care if it's a hidden miracle or it's an open miracle, we celebrate, we recognize, we thank God when a miracle happened, we were saved. And therefore, they established Purim. The same thing is true of Hanukkah, which is also post-biblical, right? These are two post-biblical holidays. What is Hanukkah? For rabbis taught on the 25th of Kislev commence the days of Hanukkah, which are eight, on which a lamentation for the dead and fasting are forbidden, right? You can't mourn, you can't do anything. For when the Greeks entered the temple, they defiled all the oils therein, and when the Hasmonean dynasty prevailed against and defeated them, they made search and found only one cruse of oil which lay with the seal of the high priest, but which contained sufficient for one day's lighting only. Yet a miracle was wrought therein, and they lit the lamp therewith for 8 days. The following year, these days were appointed a festival with a recital of Hallel and Thanksgiving. And so again, right, Hanukkah, we do the same thing. We won a battle. It was the many into the hands of the few. Even, combined with a bit of street smarts, a bit of guerrilla fighting, a bit of tactics, a bit of knowledge of the terrain, with a little bit of chutzpah, a little bit of courage, right? And we won an unlikely fight. So you have these two models of post-biblical holidays, Hanukkah and Purim, where the rabbis of the time looked and said, hey, we need to celebrate, right? We've had a miracle, right? All those, it's not necessarily an open miracle, right? In Hanukkah, you had the war, which was not an open miracle, it was a miracle. And then you had the menorah, fine, that was more of an open miracle. Purim, you only have hidden miracles where the miracle plays itself out through politics and treachery and all types of classic non-miraculous elements, right? The miracle is more in the conglomeration of all these things into a perfect storm. But the rabbi said, what we've learned from the Bible, what we've learned from Passover, what we've learned from the stories of Tanakh, is that you need to praise God. You need to find a way to celebrate and recognize and appreciate the miracles that are inherent in life, even not open miracles, but simply recognizing what God has done for us. Now, this notion was expanded by Rav Moshe Sofer, the Chatam Sofer, in the 18th century. Number three. So I had the privilege a few years ago of being the editor of the essay section of the Koren Yom Ha'atzmaut Machzor, if you've seen it. Yes, there's a Yom Ha'atzmaut Yom Yerushalayim Machzor that's put up by Koren Magid Press. So half of it is a machzor and half of it is an essay section, interesting readings on Zionism. So they asked me to be the editor for the essay section, really just choose important essays. So some of these sources are taken from the translations in those articles, because I just asked them at some point, can you send me some of the articles so I can borrow the translations, which they very nicely let me do. So this response to this few sentences from Moshe Sofer in the 18th century really becomes the key to understanding the way early religious authorities understood the state of Israel. So from the previous two sources, from the existence of post-biblical holidays, of Purim and Hanukkah, the Chatam Sofer writes as follows. He says, establishing a holiday on the day of a miracle is a biblical obligation. He said, I understand that Hanukkah and Purim are rabbinic, meaning they're post-biblical. How could they be biblical? He said, that's true, but only in the sense that the specific holiday is rabbinic. But the notion, the basic understanding that when a miracle happens to you, you need to celebrate, you need to find a way of capturing your thanks to God, that at its core is biblical. Right? Because you open the Torah, you look at Pesach, and you learn. We are supposed to appreciate when something good happened, when we were victorious. He says, as an a fortiori argument, meaning in Hebrew, a kal vachomer, meaning if this is true, then for sure this is true, right, from the Torah. In my humble opinion, the day of Purim and the days of Hanukkah are from the Torah, where they're not technically biblical, like they're post-biblical, but the idea that whenever a miracle happens to us of any sort, we need to do something, we need to celebrate, that is biblical. However, what to do on them, whether to send portions of food or light candles or commemorate them in some other way, is of rabbinic origin. Whoever does nothing to commemorate the days of Hanukkah and Purim violates a biblical positive command. And he says, you know what you learn from Purim and Hanukkah? The fact that the rabbis post-biblical felt compelled to make holidays is that you need to celebrate. When we say that they're rabbinic, all we mean is that while Pesach to figure out what you're supposed to do on Pesach, you can open up a Chumash, and you can say, you're supposed to eat matzah, you're supposed to eat maror, if there's a temple, you eat the sacrifice. On Hanukkah, you can't look anywhere in the Torah to figure it out. That's what we mean, it's rabbinic. But the notion that you need to thank God when a miracle happened, you need to celebrate, you need to appreciate what God did, that's biblical. That's what you learn from reading anything in the Torah. Yeah?
But Pesach, Shavuot, but they're all agricultural. All of their,
right. They're both historical and agricultural.
And that was an important. None of these holidays, although we should celebrate them, are not agricultural.
Correct. None of these are agricultural, right? All the biblical ones are both historical and agricultural. It's actually interesting, right? They're agricultural on the solar calendar and they're historical on the lunar calendar, right? They sort of, right? If you think about how they're described, right? Pesach is both Chag Ha'aviv, which is a solar description, right? The spring holiday, but it's also, right? Zman Cherutenu. But that happens not in Aviv, that happens in Nisan, right? And that's obviously a lunar month, right? So it's, right? You know, it's as if we're celebrating a lunar and solar holiday at the same time, right? We're celebrating the agricultural component and the historical component. I'm actually giving Sharon this in the afternoon, right? That the notion there is that we combine the two types of thanks at each holiday, right? There's the thanks for the big historical miracles, and then there's the thanks for the day-to-day, that we have food, right? That we, you know, in Pesach, it's the, right, the end of the winter, beginning of spring, then there's the harvest in the you know, at the end of the summer, and then the beginning of the harvest, middle of the summer. So we actually combine the two types of thanks, right? That we purposely combine the historical and agricultural holidays together to remind us that you thank God both for the big miracles and for the day-to-day, the fact that we have sustenance, right? So you're right. These are just historical. They're just like Purim and Hanukkah, which are just historical. They're not agricultural. And if you look at four, right, Maimonides, the Rambam, goes a little bit farther and he tells you, well, what is it that we were celebrating, right, in Hanukkah? It's not just the miracle. Because if you follow history, after the Hasmoneans won the war, in Hanukkah, there was like 200 years of, so-so sovereignty. It wasn't a great period. There was a lot of corrupt political leadership. It wasn't the best of times, but there was some sort of sovereignty. And the Rambam says, in the era of the Second Temple, the Greek kingdom issued decrees against the Jewish people, attempting to nullify their faith and refusing to allow them to observe the Torah and its commandments. They extended their hands against the property and their daughters, and they entered the sanctuary, wrought havoc within, and made the sacraments impure. The Jews suffered great difficulties from them, for they oppressed them greatly, until the God of our ancestors had mercy upon them, delivered them from their hand, and saved them. The sons of the Hasmoneans, the high priest, overcame them and slew them, and saved the Jews from their hand. They appointed a king from the priests, and sovereignty returned to Israel for more than 200 years until the destruction of the Second Temple. Accordingly, the sages of that generation ordained that these 8 days, which begin from the 25th of Kislev, should be commemorated to be 8 days of happiness and praise of God. And the Rambam adds that not only are we celebrating the miracle, we're celebrating the fact that we have sovereignty. That itself is something worth celebrating. Right? Being a sovereign state, even though the sovereignty of the Hasmoneans was really temporary in historical terms, 200 years, and it was really not a great political history. There was a lot of corruption. Still, it's worth appreciating the miracle of sovereignty, which itself is something to appreciate, even if it's not perfect.
But God doesn't want us to have a sovereign. We chose Saul. We asked God for the sovereign. And then
I don't mean a king. I mean sovereignty, meaning that our own political, right? That meaning sovereignty, that we were no longer on the rule of the Syrian Greeks. Right, I mean, whether we want a king or not is that's a long story, and that you know is debated in Tanakh, it's debated in the Talmud, it's debated in Thomas Paine's Common Sense, right? Yeah, I mean that we're a people, that we are free people. Exactly. So you look at Hanukkah and you look at Purim, and what the fact that they exist teach us that when we have a miracle of any sort, open or hidden, political, military, when we have the miracle of sovereignty, when the miracle of being granted freedom for our own destinies, all those are reasons to celebrate and turn to God. And you could just imagine the 1948 and 1967, and suddenly the question is, how do you celebrate? How do you appreciate what has just happened? What do you do? And a group of rabbis in the early state came to what I think is almost the ineluctable conclusion, which was, how is this different? We've got sovereignty, not perfect sovereignty, for sure not, right? Definitely not in 48, right? You know, it's a hodgepodge of government, right? Things are chaotic. I mean, you think about it. I mean, Israel's only, you know, is just about, you know, 70 years old, right? And, you know, where was America, you know, 70 years old, right? We were, you know, it was pre-Civil War, right? Like, things were still, you know, it's not perfect, but we've done pretty well for ourselves, right? We have an impressive military. We've gotten through these battles through a combination of miracles and, you know, open and closed miracles, right? That many into the hands of the few, combined with the same type of political confusions and military confusions that allowed us to win, that you find in stories like Gideon, and you find in stories like, you know, David and Goliath, and you find in stories like the splitting of the sea and Sanherib, right? Some combination of all types of biblical stories. And they said, well, wait a second. Did we learn nothing, right, from, you know, the point of this course, from Jew victorious, right? What does a Jew do when he's victorious, when he has sovereignty, when he's won battles? Right, so you celebrate. You have to appreciate what you did. You have to turn to God and say, wow. So that was what they said. If you look, for example, at number 5, Rabbi Meshulam Rath, who was a European rabbi who moved to Israel and was very involved in rabbinic discussions at the beginning of the state, he says, it is obvious in our case, which is relevant to the entire community of Israel and includes deliverance from slavery to freedom, because we were redeemed from the subjugation of kingdoms, and we've become free men and have achieved political independence, as well as deliverance from death to life. We were saved from the hands of our enemies who sought to exterminate us. And certainly we have an obligation to institute a holiday, and it was proper that it was established specifically on this day, which was the central miracle, that we went from slavery to freedom through the Declaration of Independence. He said, that's why Yom HaTzmud, he granted with religious significance. And that's why they say, right? That's why he said you have to say Hallel. Because how is this different than Hanukkah? How is it different than Purim or Pesach? Yeah.
And why
did the rituals do say Hallel? Right. So then the argument became, okay, well, why wouldn't you, right? So now, why do some people not say Hallel then, right?
Why do some people
not say Hallel, right? Not appreciate. Right, so, you have to divide it, right? There are some people who recognize, you know, so as the Chassam Sofer said before, right, how you celebrate, you know, you could argue about how you celebrate, right? The fact that you should celebrate in some way, doesn't argue. So you have people who are Zionists, right, religious Zionists of all stripes, some of them who will say, don't say Hallel, because whatever, they have their reasons why they don't say Hallel, but they do find ways of recognizing. So that's a very intricate, you know, rabbinic debate, which is, you know, should you add Hallel, should you celebrate the way different than Hallel? We can leave that, you know, right? That's sort of like a, but, you know, but the bigger question, right, is, okay, well, leaving aside the people who all agree that we should celebrate in some way, some saying you should say Hallel, some say you should do something else, fine. Okay, you know, we can come up with other things you could do. Hallel with a bracha, hallel without a bracha, whatever you want. You know, like, these are, you know, minor details compared to the basic. But you're right. Now, but what about the fact that some people just say, no, it wasn't a miracle? So here, right, I can explain the first two positions. The third position I have a problem with. I'm a religious Zionist, you know. I can't help it, right? I really do think that it's a, you know, in Hebrew we'd call it kafui tova, right? It's lack of, you know, gratitude to God to deny the miracle. So, just to, you know, drive home how much I believe that, right? You know, other people will say, no, it wasn't a miracle. It's an act of the Satan or something. I don't know. Or they'll say, no, we only celebrate, you know. Or, I mean, the Satmar Hasidim said, no, you're not allowed to have political independence until, you know, the Messiah comes. And others said, well, if you're going to have political independence, it has to be with a religious, you know, halachic state. You know, my tradition from my, you know, my teachers and what I believe, you know, just from reading Tanakh and from reading Gemara is that no, right? You know, we have to celebrate it, and not celebrating it is a religious problem. So I put one of my teachers in number 6.
I'm not old enough to remember the wars from the Bible or afterwards.
It's okay. I'm not old enough to remember pretty much any of the Israeli wars either, you know.
We are.
Right, I'm saying, I'm not, like, I, you know, meaning I lived through, you know, like, I was in Israel for 2014 skirmish in, you know, Gaza, but, like, you know.
It's always a very happy ending. Now, in my relatively old time, though, every time there's something that happens, today, we recognize the fellow soldiers. I never see this or hear this in any of the older things. I mean, today we have everything from Latrun. You're familiar with Latrun. We have from Latrun to when anybody mentions the Seven-Day War, they don't first think of the victory. First think of the fallen soldiers in Golan and the things that we have along the way. Those, if you've seen Exodus or you've driven along Highway Number 1 between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, through the burnt-out makeshift armored carriers, where in Exodus they have the woman burning to death. I'm talking about what's happening, and a lot of this has to do with death. Our withdrawal from southern Lebanon had a lot to do with the mother saying, "I don't want my boys dying anymore here." Can you work something like that into what we're discussing about having some recognition of men and women?
The decision that Israel made is really to combine those two, right? I mean, the decision to have Yom HaZikaron go into Yom Yerushalayim and Yom HaTzmaut is that attempt is to, right? But if you think about it in Israel, right, they try hard. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't always work, but they try to really split it. Right, like we mourn first, right, and then we celebrate. And we try to really celebrate on Yom HaTzmaut. But yeah, I think you're right. Is that, you know, historically?
Sorry,
yeah,
I don't see anything.
Right, historically, on Passover we don't. Now, Jews have a long history of celebrating. Celebrating is the wrong word, but I mean it's technically the right word, but it comes off wrong. Our losses as well, right? We have. You know, I mean, the all the mourning periods of the Omer, you know, as much as, we say it's because, you know, Rabbi Kiva's students died and things like that, meaning historically it's more related to the losses during the Crusades. But we do have a history of mourning it. What they've tried to do in Israel, which you're right, you don't really see in classic sources, is combine them, is by having, you know, that classic Israeli moment of what's called the Tekes Ma'avar, right, the transition ceremony, right? If you go to any community in Israel, they have, right, the celebration of Yom HaTzmaut starts an hour before Yom HaTzmaut. First, you have a commemoration of the losses, and then you go straight into Yom HaTzmaut. There is an attempt to bring them together. It's a very powerful thing. They actually do a good job here in Toronto. I don't know many places outside of Israel that do this, but, you know, Israel, you know, in Toronto, there is a Tekes Ma'avar. There's a transition, I think more than one, actually. I know there's one run by Mizrahi, and then is it run by the conservative shuls together? Is it run by the UJA? I don't even know how it's, whatever. I mean, I remember last year, was that Beth Tikva? Is that Beth Tikva? Yeah, it was on, what? No, on Yom
HaZikaron.
Oh, is that where it is? Because I remember, because I, no? Okay. Because I thought there was what, because I remember one person went from one to the other, because he made it, like he told me he was coming from the, but you're right, I mean, in Israel, you know, we have a separate, you know, long-standing tradition of commemorating those who we've lost. We often don't combine the two together, but in Israel, the Yom HaZikaron, Yom HaTzmaut attempt of, you know, that transition is to capture both feelings together, and it's very powerful. Like, you'll see, you know, two years ago, when we were in Israel, right, we lived in Alon Shvut. So 2 years ago, 3 years ago already, whatever it was, I'm losing track of time, it was heart-wrenching, meaning Alon Shvut was 50 meters from where the three boys were kidnapped. So we went from the Tekes Ma'avar it was, you know, the high school kids all lost their classmates. Like, it was, you know, like you see people weeping on, you know, the beginning, and then you try to celebrate to recognize that as much loss as there is, right, we need to celebrate the good that there is, because, you know, there is both. That was some of the hardest weeks of my life. It's combined with, you know, my son, he was one. We're on the sixth floor in an apartment. You have, You know, that went into rockets, and then, you know, you're running down six flights of stairs to a bomb shelter, you know, shalashudas, no shoes, you know, like, and it, you know, it was, you know, you feel both of them together, like you're thankful for what we have, and you feel the loss. You're right. You know, that's something you don't see in the you know, and partially because they're, probably because they're historical, you know, like, we celebrate everything on Tisha B'Av because it's been so long. Yom HaZikaron, Yom HaTzmaut tries to bring them together. I think you're right. Okay, yeah. If you ever get a chance to go to Tekes Ma'avar, like in Israel, it's a very powerful experience. Okay. But coming back to the question of what about people who don't recognize it? So this is an article by one of my teachers. He's the dean of the Jewish Studies Graduate School at YU, of Bernard Revel Graduate School, Rabbi Dr. David Berger. So 25 years after the Six-Day War, he wrote an article. There was a series of articles in Tradition, the journal of the Rabbinical Council of America. This is what he writes. He says, in determining whether a particular historical process is a miracle, context is almost everything. For the non-believer, the context of faith is entirely absent. And for such a person, the Israeli capture of Jerusalem, the unraveling of communism, the events of the Gulf War can reasonably be attributed to social, political, military, or economic factors. Where faith is present, context takes on a broader meaning encompassing both theology and historical evaluation. Do I believe that God intervenes frequently, even in everyday affairs, a relatively little moment? Do I think that this is a period of Hester Panim, of God's hidden faith, in which natural processes are almost invariably prevail? Do I consider divine intervention more likely in Jewish history than in the affairs of the nations of the world? Do I assign a positive, negative, or neutral evaluation to the event under consideration? Do I regard it as a passing episode or as a critical development in human history? He said, look, you know, when to point to an event and say, that was God, right? Whether it mean in your private life or national life, it's hard to figure out, can you point to God? But he says, look, although God's knowledge is unlimited, and the possibility of his intervention is always present, many major authorities have maintained that miraculous intervention in the daily lives of ordinary Jews is relatively infrequent, and some degree of uncertainty extends to larger matters as well. I am inclined to believe, for example, that God had something to do with the low casualty rate following the launching of Scud missiles towards Israel, but I do not feel my faith requires the categorical affirmation that he changed the flight path of a particular missile or caused its warhead to malfunction. He said, there are many rabbinic authorities throughout the ages who didn't think that you have to believe. You know, there are some authorities who think divine intervention means that every little thing that happens in your life, God is directly involved in. Some authorities said, you don't have to believe that. And he said, but bigger events. He said, the fact there was such a low casualty rate during, you know, the Gulf War, you can't not ascribe that to God. I don't know whether God was, you know, manipulating every Scud missile. I have no idea what his calculations are. But in the bigger picture, to believe that something, that God was doing something, I think is inescapable. And then he continues. He said, never, and this is where he really, you know, brings it down to 67 and, well, 48. It says, nonetheless, there are events that are so earth-shaking within the context of Jewish belief that the failure to attribute them to divine intervention leaves Judaism bereft of meaningful faith in the God of Chazal and of the prophets. He said, if you read Tanakh and don't celebrate huge historical events, then what did you just do with every... You read any story in Tanakh, the linchpin is that at least the big events, the big stories, God is watching over you. If you don't believe that and you don't see it in your own life, then how are you living a life that is animated by the values of Tanakh, right? The values of the Torah? He says, the establishment of the State of Israel and the capture of Jerusalem are such events, given the most fundamental assumptions about providence, the goodness of God and his concern for the Jewish people, the position that developments of such magnitude came about wholly through the working of an impersonal historical process is inadmissible. It banishes God from history. It declares, in effect, that the Lord has forsaken the earth. If the hand of God is not to be found in these events, where is it to be found? One of the great ironies in contemporary Jewish piety, this is to your question, this is what he has to respond to them. So one of the great ironies in contemporary Jewish piety is that many deeply religious Jews have inverted the hierarchy of providential events. For many non-Zionist Orthodox Jews, the operation of micro-providence is taken for granted, to the point where innumerable events in the lives of prominent rabbis are confidently regarded as miracles. He said there are all types of people who are, you know, anti-Zionist, but every little thing, they have book after book about Hashgacha Pratis, right? This, God was in my milk fell on the floor at exactly the right moment, and all types of little things that they see providence in. At the same time, the return of the land of Israel to the Jewish people is assigned no religious value whatever. It is true that God intervenes to protect the land. He guides God muscles to targets of bricks and stone in large measure because of the merit generated by students studying in Israeli yeshivot, right? They do believe that the Scud missiles missed their target because of Torah. Nonetheless, he appears to have played no role in the establishment of the state. This position is so incongruous that it is rarely, if ever, formulated in such stark terms. Nevertheless, I believe that it is a fair extrapolation from the rhetoric and behavior of many religious Jews, right? And so the response is, I can't answer it, right? The reason I'm a religious Zionist is because I feel very strongly that if we don't learn the lessons of Pesach, of Purim, of Hanukkah, of Gidon, of David, right, and celebrate and appreciate that we won battles against these odds, that God created this mass confusion of politics that led to unlikely battles and unlikely victories and gave us sovereignty after 2,000 years, if we don't find a way of appreciating that, right, we've lost the messages of Tanakh. You know, they used to ask my late teacher of Yehuda Mital, you know, where in the Torah does it say to be a Zionist? And he would always say, have you read Tanakh? Have you read it? Like, look at what if you look at victory after victory, what is the lesson you're supposed to learn? Except that you're supposed to recognize God's hand in history, right? In these huge historical events that are so unlikely in the course of history, and look at them and say, God is here. I don't know how God's providence works, but I know that this defies logic. If you don't believe, now, again, that doesn't mean open miracles, right? Because it was open in the sense that the numbers were, you know, phenomenally impressive. But the fact that just the combination of all the mistakes and all the political mistakes and the political, right, and all the political infighting in the Arab, that it led to us beating these armies that were so much bigger than us and tripling our landmass in the course of 6 days. Like, how can you not look at it and say, if we're true to the values that permeate Tanakh, that we have to celebrate. We have to say, God is here. And if you look, Reb Chaim Drukman, who's a current rabbi in Israel, summarizes this as follows. He says, the many into the hands of the few. He said, on the eve of the declaration of independence of the state of Israel, the Arab countries declared that within a week they intended to wipe out the entire yeshuv, Jewish population of the land of Israel. The Arab army's proclamation, we will drive you into the sea, was not a figure of speech, but rather a serious threat to invade the land of Israel from the north, east, and south, through the Mediterranean Sea to the west, were the Jews' last refuge. Is there a better example of the many into the hands of the few? On Hanukkah, we repeatedly recite the Alei Nisim prayer, in which we thank God for delivering the many into the hands of the few. The Hanukkah miracle took place more than 2,000 years ago, but this wondrous event has happened also in our time. God delivered the many into the hands of the few, and thus saved us from certain death, and gave us the gift of our own lives. Is it not appropriate that we thank Him for this? I think that's really, right, what people who are both believers and are Zionists, I think part of what drives them to be such passionate Zionists is this, is the belief that we're reliving miracles of biblical proportions, literally. And that's, as, you know, Dr. Bergen said, the critique of people who consider themselves religious but aren't Zionists. And, you know, I share that critique. At the flip side, right, it also, the lessons to learn are not just that you have to thank God, you know, as a believer, but it's also the opposite, is that people who aren't believers, right, there's also, you know, from a religious perspective, you look at it and you say, that's also a problem. To ascribe it all to ourselves is also a problem. So if you look, for example, number 8, right, the Torah tells us as follows, that when you have eaten your fill, God predicts a time when everything will be good in Israel, right, which is, you know, thank God where we are, things are scary, but they're better than they were for many thousands of years. You know, I have a house being built in, you know, in Efrat, you know, in, you know, beautiful yeshuv, 8 minutes south of Jerusalem. You know, it'll be a bit scary, but you know what? Like, you know, I've lived there, you know, I lived there for years, at least near there. It's beautiful, right? The economy is booming. You know, It's almost impossible to buy anything with Canadian dollars because the shekel is so strong, right? We're living off, we're living off our, as Ambassador Ayalon said a few weeks ago when he was here, right? We're living off our intellectual property, right? We it's the Silicon Valley of the world, modern miracles in terms of agriculture. So God predicts that one day this is the situation we'll live in. He says, when you've eaten your fill and you have built fine houses to live in, and your herds and flocks have multiplied, and your silver and gold have increased, and everything you own has prospered, beware, lest your heart grow haughty and you forget the Lord your God, who freed you from the land of Egypt, the house of bondage, who led you through the great and terrible wilderness with its seraph, serpents, and scorpions, a parched land with no water in it, who brought forth for you from the flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers had never known, in order to test you by hardship, only to benefit you in the end. And you say to yourselves, right, Kochiv otem yadi asali erachayel azeh, my own power and the might of my own hand have won this wealth for me. Remember that it is the Lord your God who gives you the power to get wealth, the fulfillment of the covenant that he made on oath with your fathers, as is still the case. And the Torah tells you, on the one hand, when the miracle happens, you need to appreciate it's a miracle. But that cuts both ways, right? To live through this and to just say it's random historical processes, it's because the IDF is so powerful, also misses the point, right? You're not supposed to. You're supposed to be able to say, we couldn't have done this if there wasn't more to history than the IDF is a really good army with good intelligence. Or you have to look at it and say, I mean, that may be true, but isn't that a miracle? Like, we're a tiny little nation in the middle of a huge, hostile area, and we managed to be a regional superpower and an economic superpower in terms of intellectual property, right, that we're second in patents only to Silicon Valley. Like, that's actually, it's a country of not so many people, right, of 7 million people, whatever it is, right, the size of New Jersey, right, it is a miracle. You can't just say, well, no, it's not a miracle. It's because we have a strong army and we have a strong economy. No, the fact that we have a strong army and a strong economy, right, is against all odds. You can't, if you look at it and just say, Kochiv otzem yadi asali erachayel azeh, just me, you're missing the point. Right? The lessons of the Jew victorious throughout history is that you have to recognize that God is involved. You can't. It's not that you deny that your own involvement. You can feel proud. It's not that you deny the losses that we've had to get to the point where we are, right? You need a Yom HaZikaron for every Yom HaTzmaut. You need to recognize the human sacrifice that went into what we have. But you need to say that it's not just me, right? To quote President Obama, right? You didn't make that, right? I mean, you did make that, but you didn't make it by yourself, right? Everything's in context, right? And it's a context with God. And, there was an attempt by secular Zionists really to get rid of that actively. You know, I put in 9, where the classic was that on Hanukkah, the secular Zionist classic song became Mi Yimalel Kurot Yisrael, right? Who shall praise the strength of Israel? Which is a twist of a pasuk, right? The verse in Tehillim is Mi Yimalel Kurot Hashem, who shall praise God? And they took out God actively and put in Yisrael, put in the Jews, because they wanted to take out God. Or if you want a worse one, look at 10. Right, this is a song from Aaron Zev, who was a secular Zionist, it right, which translates as follows: we are carrying torches in the dark night, the paths shine beneath our feet, and whoever has a heart that thirsts for light, let him lift his eyes and his heart to us and come along. And then the Hebrew here is Nes lo karanu lo karalanu, no miracle happened for us. Pachshem en lo matzanu, we found no cruse of oil. We walked through the valley and ascended the mountain. Right? There was an attempt to actively say, no, there is no miracle, there's no God, there's no nothing.
These
were written very early. Right? These are written, some of them are in the late 19th century. Hashem HaTzair, right? There's an excellent article, I can send it out in the link afterwards, called The Secular Zionist Hanukkah. Or I can send up my lecture at the beginning of the year if you want. Or I can send up both. Where there was this move of reading us as the modern Maccabees, but without the God, right? If you read the Book of Maccabees, yes, they were guerrilla warriors that beat an impressive force, but they said Mi Hashem Eli, right? They were fighting for God, and they comforted each other by saying we can fight because God is with us, just like King David did when he fought Goliath. But modern religious, as secular Zionists, tried to read God out of it, to be the modern Maccabees without God, right? The modern right? Esther and Mordechai, without, right, God behind the story, without. And I think that if we, you know, if we want to create a religious context to understand the state of Israel and the miracles that we have seen, you know, and continue to live through, you know, on the one hand, you know, we have to, you know, at least from a perspective of Torah, we have to recognize that the dangers of saying, well, I can explain this all in rational terms, because at this point we have a strong army and a strong economy, and they don't, so who cares if there's a lot of them? It's not so miraculous that we're beating them, and to realize, no, that is a miracle. Right, the fact that historically we've managed to come this far, right? The United States of America, 7 years after it was established, was pre-Civil War, right? You think historically, we were still, you know, in 1812, we were still fighting with Canada, right? I mean, Great Britain, but sure. We were fighting with Canada. You, right, I'm saying, the United States. I'm an American, you know. We're
Canadian.
Yes. Canada and America were still fighting in 1812, right? Like, it took a while till things became... They're still fighting, yeah, sure. You know, not military, but... And the fact that 70 years in, like, we've won these battles, that we've managed, because of the incompetence and lack of communication often between the Arab countries, to, you know, to play off of that and win. And the fact that we've built a strong army and an economy, and that we're victorious, and that we have, you know, we're somewhat calm in our land, and we have some level of sovereignty, with all the terror that there is and all the problems that there is in the UN and all, still we're in a much better state than we ever were, right? And that it was so unlikely, if we look at it and say, on the one, and we don't say, right, God did something, then we're just ignoring, right, God's hand. And on the other hand, if we claim to be religious and see God's hand in everything but the big historical processes, right, you're also missing something. Show so in, as